to sound right, boys.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night. I'm Hunter, joined as always by Brody remotely, Silas in the studio. Yo. Brody's back in Texas, rocking one of the new Dark Horse hats, it looks like, Brody. You want to go over the drop stuff now, or you want to wait a little bit into the show before you go over all the? Oh, you're rocking a Get Freaky shirt too. I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, if people have questions or want to hear about the drop tomorrow, I can let them know. But we can start the show.
Okay, nice. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people are here for. Well, I mean, the elephant in the room, which is we got to hear a little bit about what went down at the Preserve. It was one of your worst performances in recent history. Okay, ever. I didn't know how it felt to you. I think you ended in 80th place when it was all said and done. You'd been on a pretty good streak of like top 40. Like you could typically count yourself like top 30. So 80 was definitely a surprise. You were my dark horse pick on Griplock this week, so I am a little bit salty about that as well.
Yikes.
Now, Connor picked Casey White, so it would have been a decent ask for you to get to beat him anyways, but I still felt like, you know, I thought this course played pretty well to you. So I got to hear from your perspective kind of what happened out there, and then obviously we've got to hear the story of the snowman as well.
Yeah, I feel like this week was... the past week was just a combination of like a lot of things all at once, and I handled them very, very poorly. So the thing I'll never do is I'll never just like make an excuse and be like, well, this happened, so therefore that's why I played bad. I think there's always things that you can do to make a situation better or worse, depending on how you handle it. Now, this was a really weird week for me, obviously, and I feel like I just handled it really, really poorly, and a bunch of things just didn't go well for me all at once, which basically made it like the perfect storm. So obviously people know that I was at Am Worlds on Wednesday. That travel schedule was really, really difficult to fly into Minneapolis on Monday, fly out of Minneapolis on Tuesday, fly back to Minneapolis on Thursday morning, and then play the tournament the next day. Big problem too with that really was the travel. So my flight to Minneapolis, not too bad, like 2.5 hours from Dallas, but flight from Minneapolis to Evansville, Indiana was, I believe, 8 hours one way and like almost 10 hours the other way, because I had to fly to Charlotte.
Yeah.
And then I had to fly from Charlotte to Evansville. And then obviously the it's an hour and a half drive or an hour drive from Minneapolis to the actual course. So going into the tournament, it wasn't definitely the way I wanted to prepare.
Yeah.
There were still a lot of holes that I was very unsure of how I wanted to play. And I think this was the first time that filming the practice round and filming the doubles battle kind of hurt me because when you do those rounds, like the practice round, yes, we talk about shots and we try to figure it out. But when you do those rounds, you don't really actually have the time to really test out, especially in the doubles battle. You don't really have the time of just being on the course by yourself or being able to just like sit at a hole and try to figure out the hole. And that was the one thing that I wasn't able to do for a couple holes. And I still was confident though going into the tournament, because Jonesboro was something similar of where I came into, DDO. I came into DDO later than I would have liked to because of the Big Skins Eagles Crossing match.
Yeah.
But I had already played Emporia before. I had already played that course. Obviously, some holes were different, but I'd already been on that course and played some of the holes. And then I did get like 2 or 3 practice rounds in, like really good practice rounds. So I felt really good with those courses. So I still was trying to put like good vibes in my head. And obviously Preserve was a tournament that I had circled, being like, this is like, if there's one that I have a good chance of winning, like the Preserve is definitely one of those that I felt like how the course set up sort of sets up really well for my game. So yeah, it was very disappointing to have a lot of things go poorly for me in the tournament. Yeah, it was a combination of not being consistent off the tee, like really struggling with confidence on knowing where the disc was going. And then my putting was just, I missed a couple early putts. And when that happens to me, I have a hard time right now, like getting that out of my head and stepping up to the next putt. That's why I keep trying to tell myself is like, even though I've missed two putts in a row, the next putt, I still have the same percentage of making as I previously did. And I felt like I was constantly trying to change and try to figure out my putt. And when your putt's not working, then you puts a lot of pressure on your upshots, puts a lot of pressure on your tee shots to try to get the disc closer to the basket. And when I was already kind of iffy off the tee, that really caused a lot of problems. And, there was multiple mental errors and it was just a combination of a lot of really bad stuff. And my result at the tournament is not surprising obviously it's surprising based off of like my previous results.
Yeah.
But it wasn't surprising for me. It was there's a lot of topics that we can dive into off of this weekend, but this one tournament definitely made me wish there was a cut.
Oh yeah.
I really wish like cut the bleeding, finish me off. I don't need to play on Sunday.
You know?
So that's never a good feeling to have in a tournament of where you just are out of it already because of how bad you played. Because obviously I played terrible the first day. That was maybe one of the worst rounds I've ever played in. And I was having like slight back issues towards the end, but that doesn't, you could easily walk away and be like, yeah, my back was tightening up. I could barely move. And everyone could be like, oh, well, that's why Brody played so bad. But that was only happening like the last four holes. Mm. I was still like 3 over par or 2 over par going into those last four holes. So explain that. That's what I'm saying. It's like, it wasn't just, I can't just say, oh, my back was tightening up because of all the travel. Like, my back felt fine on hole 2. My back felt fine on hole 1, on hole 5, on hole 10. So that's the frustrating thing. It's like after the first day, I was so far down the leaderboard. And the second round, I was like, all right, let me try to have like a decent round. Because I can shoot 9, 10, 11, 12 under par on that course. So I was like, let me go out, try to have a decent round. And then that puts me in potential contention to cash. And that to me, if I can somehow work myself back into cash after almost being in last place, essentially. But then you quickly realize like when you shoot that much over par and that much difference on the entire field on a course that is pretty easy in the sense of like just scoring ability. To think that I could have gone 18 under and still not even won the tournament, that just shows you how bad I played the first day.
Yeah, that definitely puts it into a little bit of perspective. I mean, we obviously got to walk through one hole in particular, which I don't know how much of the full story behind the hole is out there at this point, but you took an 8 on the double Mando hole, par 3. Walk us through, well, first off, walk us through kind of how you got that 8 and then behind it, the story behind it.
Yeah, I played that hole 6 over par for the 3 rounds.
Nice.
And then I played the hole 10 par 3 at 4 over par. Or sorry, 3 over par. I doubled, birdied, doubled that hole. So those two holes, I almost played at 10 over par, which not great. All right, so I have a disc here so I can exactly show you.
Are you just going to draw on this disc?
Yeah, I'm not going to throw this. Oh. I mean, I can still throw it. What the heck? You can.
Hey, if you're not going to throw it, send it to our U section after you draw on
it. A Sharpie. All right. This can go in the U section.
If you're not going to throw it, we'll take it.
So here is the T-pad.
Okay.
All right. Here is the FPO T-pad. And then here are the two trees for the double Mando.
Nice.
Okay.
Yep.
The basket is like way down here.
It's a great drawing.
Thank you. Okay. So I've got the whole kind of set up right now.
Yeah.
All right. Let me first just give you a heads up of like where my mind is going into this hole. Okay. I have first hole, easy par four. You literally throw it in bounds, you're going to birdie the hole. I had like a 27 footer for birdie. I go to try to find my mini. I ended up switching bags from my, what do we call the tan bag? What color is that?
Sahara.
I switched from the Sahara to the green bag. What's the technical term for that?
The Ranger.
Ranger. So I went Sahara to green for my Atlas bag.
Yeah.
I switched everything over, right? I got my Atlas pouch with my sports sack inside. I got my Get Freaky and Dark Horse towels. I've got everything, my rangefinder, everything has switched over. The one thing I forgot to switch was my mini.
Mm.
So I don't have a mini. So now I kind of go back to like Ledgestone where I don't have that Thrasher.
Oh boy.
Very similar situation of where I'm just frazzled. So I go up. What do? I clank it off the cage. So now that is where my headspace is going into now hole two. We also have, it was me, Albert Tam, and then two other guys that were super nice. I think one of them might've even been local, and we actually had a pretty big gallery. I would, 50 or 60 people watching. So these people said they need trees. Okay. Let me try to, that's a pretty good tree.
Oh boy. I'm going to be here a little bit. Happy trees.
No, we're fine. Okay. Those are the two main trees. I'm not going to draw all the trees after that, but there's like a lot of trees over here and then a lot of trees over here. And there's one tree right in the middle. So the way that a lot of people play it from the tee pad here is they'll throw like a straight shot kind of up the right-hand side and then let it fade out a little bit. But when you throw the straight shot, it makes this gap a little bit tighter because you kind of have to hug the right side. But what a lot of people do is they'll throw like more of a flex line, kind of something flat that will kind of go straight and then turn and then finish at the end.
Mm.
Okay. So I played this hole terrible the two times I did in practice.
Okay.
Like terrible. And I kind of was just like, oh, I'll dark horse it during the tournament. I'll figure it out. My first throw was with my dark horse buzz. That's kind of beat in straight early release. Boom. Missed. Mando. Okay. We'll do a ticker over here. First throw. Okay. Is this backwards size? Can you flip this?
No, it's right.
Okay. It's right for you. Okay. So that's first throw.
That's right.
So at this point, I'm now walking up to the FPO tee pad. And really what I'm doing is I'm seeing if there is a drop zone up by the Mando.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
And I don't see any drop zone up by the Mando. So then I look at the FPO pad and I look at what happens when they miss the Mando. Now, granted, as you can see by my drawing, the trees to the Mando and the FPO pad are roughly 10 feet off. So how do you miss the Mando from the FPO tee pad? No clue. But if you do miss the Mando from the FPO tee pad, it says re-tee. So then I'm like, okay, so let me go back. So then I do a little U-turn and I walk all the way back to our tee sign. Now people on my card are looking at the tee sign as well. So I look at the tee sign and we read it out as if you miss the Mando, you have to re-tee from the MPO tee pad. So I was like, all right, grab another disc. I grab another disc. My caddy starts walking away. I tell him, no, stay here just in case. Don't walk away. I grab my my other buzz, grip lock, miss right. That's my second throw, miss Mando. Now I'm grabbing a get freaky zone, my beat in one. So now I'm trying to like, whatever, miss, bam, bip, miss, three. Now I'm down. I'm like, at this point, I'm almost thinking in my head, like, do I need to walk up and grab these discs to rethrow them? Because I'm starting to now like not throw discs that I probably really want to throw on this.
Yeah.
I grab my new pink get freaky that I put in the bag. This time I make it through the Mando, curve it, boom, land it about 40 feet short. So now I'm doing the math in my head. Throw one, miss the Mando. Throw three, miss the Mando. Throw five, miss the Mando. Throw seven. So now I'm walking up to a 40-footer for an eight. I cash the putt. I get an eight. Okay. You listening or watching us live right now are probably all thinking to yourself, like, what the heck? How, like, when you're watching this eight happen, you're probably thinking, like, how the heck did Brody get an eight on this hole? I didn't think it was that crazy because, like, obviously the Mando's kind of small. Like, it's not like a super huge gap where it's like you can't miss. And we are like probably 80 to 100 feet away from it. So I wasn't like, oh, it's a preposterous thing for someone to get an eight on this hole, especially if you miss the Mando twice and then like three putt or something, you can still get an eight, right? Yeah. So I get all these tweets and stuff of people being like, bro, how did you get an eight? What happened? What happened? And then I told him, I was like, I just missed the Mando three times. It took me four throws to get through the Mando.
Yeah.
And they all go, what? Like, how did you miss the Mando two more times from the FPO pad? I'm like, what are you talking about? Threw it from the MPO pad. They're like, no, the drop zone for the Miss Mando's FPO. I'm like, what? They're like, yeah, look at the caddy book. So I go, I open up the caddy book, and there and behold, yes. If you miss the Mando, you can walk up to the FPO T pad. Mm. Now, did I play the hole incorrectly? No. Did I play the hole a lot more difficult? Yes.
Yeah.
It was. So apparently the situation was the T-pad sign was incorrect. Unfortunately, no one caught it. And yeah. Now, I did hear Kevin Jones also played it incorrect. Not incorrect, but played it harder.
Yeah.
I heard he missed the Mando, re-teed, but made it on his second shot. So yeah, there it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting situation because, like, we were talking about it a little bit, and it's a weird one because typically, like, you never go by the tee signs ever. It's the caddy book. But at a Pro Tour event, the Pro Tour makes the tee signs. So, like, typically what's in the caddy
book...
They're
supposed to be identical.
Yeah, I was going to say, typically the caddy book and the tee signs are the exact same thing. Like, it's a very... Like, the caddy book is the tee signs.
The only time I ever look at the caddy book is when I'm not near a tee sign. So if I'm playing like a par four and I'm up by my drive, well, of course, I'm not going to walk all the way back to the tee sign. I can just look it up in the caddy book. In this situation, we are right next to this tee sign. So like, no one even thought like, oh, let me check the caddy book to make sure the caddy book is the same. It was an unfortunate thing, but my hope from it, and again, it's something that I didn't play the hole incorrectly.
Yeah.
You know, I played it just
you always
more
have
difficult.
The, you always have the option to abandon a lie and rethrow from your previous lie.
Yeah. I definitely wish I could have played it from the FPO tee pad because I think, you know, my worst score in that situation, I mean, in that situation, I could have stayed a bogey.
Yeah.
But my worst score probably is going to be a five.
Yeah.
And I take a double and I move on. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty tough missing a birdie putt on hole one and then taking a, I don't even know what that is. I don't even know what five over par is. I know quad is four over, but yeah, being five over par after two holes is a tough pill to swallow. So definitely would have liked it another way, but I'm hoping this situation, I'm hoping something comes from it. And we can dig into this now. I think we need to have like rules that are just like, this is how you play disc golf when you're playing on a disc golf pro tour event.
Well, I mean, they,
and
yeah,
and get away from hole specific rules, because I'll give you another story. Ready for this one? This is on hole 7. So the big par 5 that used to be two fairways, but now there's only one fairway on the right. If you threw it in the water, you had to play, you either had a re-tee or you got drop zone from the FPO tee pad.
Okay.
Okay. Those were your two options. Someone threw it in the water. Okay. And then called provisional from the MPO tee pad. They re-teed, called provisional.
Okay.
And then went up and threw another shot from the FPO tee pad.
Okay.
And took the FPO tee pad throw. You can't do that.
Why?
If you call provisional, the only reason you're calling a provisional is because you are thinking that the way you're playing it is incorrect.
Yeah.
So you say provisional in case. Well, obviously you say provisional too. If you like throw a shot and you think it's out of bounds, you don't know if it's in or out.
Yeah.
And if it's stroke and distance, you call provisional and then you get up there and you see whether it's in or out. But if you don't know where, like if you don't know, you know, if there's a drop zone or whatever, if you throw from the MPO tee pad, you re-tee essentially and you call provisional, you can't take the other shot.
Well,
because
yeah.
what you're throwing right there is correct. Oh, we got bots in the chat.
Yeah. I just noticed it popping up over here while you're talking. But
Silas, I blocked them for you, Silas.
There you go. So for instance, back to what you did on hole 2, right? If you would have called a provisional and then played from the FPO tee pad and then discovered that what you did
from
the FPO tee pad
was right. No, but you can't. What you would do in that situation, Hunter, is I would go up to the FPO tee pad.
Yeah.
Call provisional and throw that shot.
Oh, so they basically threw a tee shot.
And then go back to the MPO tee pad because I know I can play the MPO tee pad. I know I can always re-tee. So you do the thing that you don't know if you can or can't do. Does that make sense? You see what I'm saying?
Somewhat. Not fully. Because like, okay. Well, does the order, I guess in the PDGA rulebook, the question is, does
the order does matter.
In the rulebook, yes, it matters?
Because the way this person did it, he was able to pick and choose which one he wanted to play from. You can't throw two shots and then pick, oh, I'm going to play this one. You can't call provisional on a shot that you know you can play from. You can always re-tee. So if you don't know if you can go to a drop zone, like if you don't know if a drop zone exists,
yeah,
or if you don't know, then you need to go, to the place that you don't know whether or not you can play from, throw from there and call provisional and say, if I can play from here, I'm going to, because this is more advantageous to me. If I can't play from here, then I'm going to play where I know I can.
Well,
from
typically
the MPO
tee pad. The provisional, what should have happened is both should be played all the way out and then you take it into the TD. Like that's the point of a provisional. Cause then like it doesn't,
but
at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what's thrown first or second.
So what score is he taking? If he got a 7 from re-teeing and he got a 5 from the drop zone, what score does he take?
The 5.
Okay. If he got a 5 from re-teeing and a 7 from the drop zone, what score is he taking?
That's up to the TD. Cause like that's where it's weird. A situation like why did he
take the lower score in the first situation?
Because he could. You have the option. You have both options.
You can't pick, you don't know if that's
an option or not.
You can't pick and choose what disc you want. You can't throw two discs and say, well, this one was a better shot.
But that's not really what you're doing, though. Because like,
it is.
It's exactly your situation, right? Back to hole 2. It's exactly your situation. If you would have said, hey, like, because technically, if someone has a drop zone, the PDGA rule is there has to be there, or if someone has a Mando, there has to be a drop zone. That's the PDGA rule.
Whichever one I would have thrown first, I would have taken, Hunter.
But I'm saying, if you didn't know
my situation,
if you didn't know it was a drop zone, though, if you had no idea that the red tee was a drop zone,
no, let's do my situation. Let's do my situation exactly.
Okay.
So my situation of where in our situation, we're like thinking like, I think the FPO should be a drop zone, but we're looking at it and it doesn't look like that. If I would have gone up to the FPO tee pad and said provisional, I'm going to play from here because it's easier and I want to play from here if I can, but if I can't, then that's why it's a provisional. And I throw the provisional straight into a tree and it drops.
Yeah.
And then flash forward, I play that out and I take a 10. So after I play, throw the shot straight into a tree, I walk back to the MPO tee pad, right? And I'm like, all right, I'm going to throw this shot in case I can't play that one. And I ace it to get a 3. I'm taking the 10 because that I called provisional saying, if I can't play from here, then I have to go back here and play. But I could play from there, so I take the 10.
So I guess now, in the scenario of the other person.
So rewind.
Yeah.
So rewind. I'm going to do – that's how you should play it. Now I'm going to do it the scenario that this person did it, which is the incorrect way, of where they are playing from the spot that they know they can play from. And they say provisional, and they throw from the MPO tee pad. Okay? And they take a 10, and then they go up to the FPO tee pad, and they ace it for a 3 – they still get the 10. Even though they could have played for the FPO, they still take the 10 because in that scenario, you can play both ways. And in that scenario, you can't pick and choose which one you want to play from the lower score. You have to go off the first disc in play that was correct, which was the MPO tee pad.
So I think
that
it
is live.
When rubber meets the road, the issue here is they just called provisional on the wrong throw. Because basically what they should have said was, hey, I'm going to take a provisional from the FPO tee pad, but to save time, I'm going to go ahead and re-tee here like I know I can, and then take my provisional from the FPO tee pad. Because that's basically what they did, but they called provisional on the MPO tee pad. Because if they would have done that, I just read the provisional rule. Basically, a provisional is an extra throw that's not added. If it's not ultimately used, the player must inform the group they're throwing a provisional, and it explains why you use a provisional. But basically, I think if you call a provisional, you're saying like, hey, I'm calling a provisional because if I can take the red tee pad, I'm going to. So basically, if you call the provisional on the FPO tee pad, then no matter what happens, you don't have a choice to take the other one. You don't.
But you have to throw that first, though.
It doesn't say that.
Okay, now hear me out here. How does that make any sense? Hear me out. No, yeah. Ready for this situation. I throw it in the water.
Okay.
We're gonna go back to hole 7 again because that's the easiest one to think about. I throw it into the water. We might have just figured out that this rule just makes no sense then. I throw it in the water. So now in my head, I'm like, I just want to re-tee here because I like the re-tee here way more than the drop zone. I'm thinking that in my head. I haven't said that to anyone. I'm thinking that in my head. I throw the next shot in the water because by what you just said, I can wait to say provisional on the other shot.
No.
What are you talking? I have to say provisional on the MPO tee pad?
I'm saying you're like saying, hey, I'm going to walk up, I'm going to throw a provisional from the FPO tee pad, but just to save time, I'm going to throw from here and then walk up and take my provisional. But like I'm throwing the provisional either
when
way.
When do you have to say that? When do you have to say that?
You have to say it when
but
you...
But
when
you're not saying provisional when you throw... So what was the throw that you just threw?
The one you know that you can do. Because like that's typically a provisional is like a provisional.
So how are you not playing that one? How are you not playing that one? You just threw a disc that you know for a fact you can play. Should you always do the thing that you don't know you can do or not first?
But then what's the point of a provisional at all? Because like a lot of provisionals are like, my disc might be in bounds up there or not. I'm going to call a provisional and throw the one I know I can play either way right here. And then if I'm in bounds, I'll play from that.
Because in that situation, you're saying I'm throwing this disc not knowing my situation. That's way different. You know your disc is already out of bounds.
Yeah.
You don't know where to go.
Yeah.
But you know 100% that you can re-tee. you know 100% that you can reteat. My issue is if you throw from a spot that you know 100% that you can throw from, how do you distinguish which one you play? Do you play from which? Do you always just play from?
Well, if you call a provisional
spot?
No, if you call a provisional, it's saying the intent of a provisional is saying if I can do this, this is what I'm going to do. So when I call a provisional, that's what I'm saying.
But I literally just asked you if two people did the same exact thing. Okay?
Yeah, I was wrong.
Both went
I was
to
wrong
the water,
in that answer.
No,
you take the Red Sea both times. A provisional, the way they messed up was that both scores, when you call a provisional, need to be played all the way out. Both scores, okay, no matter what, need to be played all the way out. You go to the TD, you say, hey, I took this provisional. I played one from the Red Sea, one from the tee. Could I go from the Red Sea? If they say yes, you take the one from the Red Sea every time. You have to. You called a provisional and you played that. That's what you're saying. It's like, hey, I'm calling a provisional because I don't know if I can do this, but I'm playing it because if I can, this is the score I'm taking. So if you go, you re-tee and you take a 5 or 6 from the long tee, then you played a provisional and you took the red tee and you took a 10
that
from
makes
there,
sense.
Then you have to take the
that
10.
That makes sense.
Because the provisional is saying, my intent is to play from the red tee. I don't know if I can. But a provisional, you have to play them both out until the TD comes up and explains to you why you can't, or you come up there and you're, I am in bounds. Those are the only way you don't play a provisional all the way out.
I'm thinking, though, in this situation, I'm thinking that this person ended up picking and choosing what drive they wanted to play.
So that would technically be illegal. Because
obviously when they walked up there and saw that they could take the drop zone there or whatever, I think what you just said is correct, of where okay, hear me out. I think what you just said is the right way of doing it.
Yeah.
Of where if you're basically saying, if I can play up there, I'm basically taking that score no matter what.
Yeah. So the second you know you can play up there, whether it's on the hole or after the round, that's the score. That's the one you're playing.
My point now, because I think we both agree that I was wrong in I still think if you can, you probably do the throw. If it's close enough, you probably do the one that you don't know for sure whether or not you can play that way as provisional. And then you do the one that you know for sure you can do second. I feel like that is ideally what you're supposed to do for the most part. But in a scenario like this where the walk is super far, it doesn't really make, like you said, it doesn't really make sense to walk all the way to the FPO tee pad, throw, say provisional, and then walk all the way back and throw again. My point now, though, is how many people play that incorrectly. Like we just talked by a bunch. A bunch of people in the chat still think what I say is right. So I just don't think the rules necessarily like explain that well enough to, and like even you were confused at what scores the person should take initially, right? So yeah. My question is like, how many times does someone take a 10 and a 5 and they just end up just getting to decide which they're like, well, I could have played both, so I guess I'll just take the 5.
I mean, if that happens,
this
it's
goes
wrong.
Back. But this goes back to my whole point of like, I think we need to have rules that are just like super simplified and it's the same exact way how to play all the time.
Well, I mean, it should just be, it technically is like it, like you were teeing from OB there on that hole. So you had to have a drop zone. It's in the rules. There wasn't an option.
No.
Your next lie cannot be OB in any situation.
But no, we've played holes like that.
The only way is if they get a waiver. Like hole 17 at USDGC, then that's a waiver.
No, I'm saying I'm trying to remember if we've played holes where are like that, but if you cross, you take it from where you cross and bounce.
So that's like normal OB rules. Because this is just playing like an island is what's going on.
Yes. Yes.
An island PDJ has to have a drop zone. That's why USDGC like has always been an X major, because they refused that rule with hole 17.
Yeah.
So like there are standard sets of rules. So like, but really the issue in that situation is like, and in your situation is the T signs should have the correct rules and clearly stated. So I think there should never be a reason for a provisional in either of those situations, because it should just be like, what do? I look at the T sign. Okay, I can go to the drop zone or I can re-tee. The only provisional that would come up is be like, why can't I take my disc up there? okay, I'm gonna just throw a provisional from the drop zone in case I can, like, and take my disc from up there how I think I should play it. That should be like the only time a provisional comes in, is if it's like some weird question where someone's trying to appeal a rule that's very clear already. The issue is, like, in this case, a provisional is being used against a rule that should be very obvious. That's why it doesn't make any sense, because it's like, why is a provisional being used there? That's like, if a disc falls out the bottom of the basket, Coriolis is like, well, I'm going to call it provisional and tap it in. It's like, you can, but like, the rule's clear. It fell out the bottom of the basket. Like, I don't really know.
Yeah.
It's open.
No, you're right on that. I think going back to my initial point, though, is I think there are things that can be put in place to really simplify rules to where these discussions don't even come up. And, you know, I think right now there are so many, like, there's just one term for something, like OB.
Yeah.
And the way you play OB is very different. I mean, going back to the Goat Hill situation, or not Goat Hill, Masters Cup situation, where we played that one hole where the disc actually had a hit in bounds for you to take it up there. If it just flew over and never touched in bounds, you had to re-throw. Like, there are so many different, obviously, but like, that's a rare case.
Well, that's illegal still to this day.
I know.
You can't use an illegal rule that just happened to be played.
I mean, but how crazy is that? That was at a Silver Series event. We played under that.
I don't understand how that happened.
Like, that still hasn't even been brought up as like a crazy thing. But I guess my point, kind of going back to it, is I do think we need some sort of like coloring system or some sort of renaming system of where everyone is on the same page, because it's happened on coverage a couple times this year of where people are blatantly not on purpose. That's the thing too, is they're not cheating. They're not doing something knowingly of like, oh, I'm trying to get by.
Yeah.
But people have played holes completely incorrect without even knowing it.
Yeah.
And this is where I think it's just like, let's just simplify things. Like, if you're playing, do we need a drop zone on a par four for the tee shot or for the second shot? I don't think so.
Only if it's like a weird green, but
why even need a drop zone there?
Just keep re-throwing. I agree that for a tee on par four, like, no. Well, that's where, like, when rubber meets the road.
A drop zone to me should only happen really on a par three, right? Of where
for the
like
most part,
you have a really difficult par three shot, and they give you the option of moving forward, and you still have to have a really hard. Like, did you watch hole 10 at all? Do you remember hole 10? It's the one with the big wall in front. It's like a 350 foot par three.
Yeah,
they move the basket up closer to the water. So like that drop zone, for example, in years past, like I bet drop zone in years past would be like a 40-foot death putt. And everyone would be thinking, oh my gosh, this is a sick drop zone.
Yeah.
This year, I'm not saying that's what it was in the past. I'm just saying that was like a typical disc golf thing of where it's like, oh, let's give him a 40-foot death putt for par. Where this situation, like I doubled that hole twice because I threw it OB, I threw it in the water, I went to the drop zone, and now getting up and down for bogey is still difficult, and I wasn't able to get up and down for bogey both times.
Yeah.
To me, I love that because that second shot I have to do, I still have to execute the same shot. It's just at like 280 feet instead of 350. So like to me, drop zones on par threes make a whole lot of sense. Missing mandos on like par fours or par fives and advancing all the way up, that doesn't make sense to me either.
Yeah.
Like if you miss the mando, guess what? You re-throw.
Mm. Yeah.
You don't get an advance. Like if you shake a shot way off, you don't get an advance all the way up to the middle of the fairway and get a throw your next shot. Like I'm just saying there's small little things I feel like that can simplify rules to where, I mean, how many times do you listen to commentators being like, oh, is that OB? Are they playing from out of bounds or is that a hazard? Or
yeah,
it's very hard for everyone to know what's going on. And so,
well, that's where I think
that's my hope comes from this.
We got two super chats.
Okay.
Both from Michael.
Michael,
he says, I'll do $10 more if Hunter takes off his hat for the rest of the podcast.
Easiest $10 we've ever made.
Admits He's a 940 rated player.
So do I lie or take my hat off? I think I'll take my hat off.
There you go. He also says, will Hunter break 60 at Trophy Lakes Blues?
So this is coming from the same guy that thought I was 940?
Same guy.
Then yeah, I'll break 60.
All right, there you go, Michael.
Surely.
Trophy. When are we playing Trophy Lake? What day is that?
I don't know if you'll play it or not.
We just
got out. So turns out we have a connection.
You don't even know when I'm flying in. I don't even have flights booked.
You told
yet.
Me you Thursday night. You said in. Thursday afternoon.
You don't know that.
I mean, if you fly in earlier, yeah, you might play Trophy Lakes. Because we're
might change.
Foundation versus the Nation and possibly the Creators Cup. Carson's uncle owns the course down there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So his course like needs tee pads. So we're gonna do Foundation versus the Nation at his course to help raise money for tee pads. I like was looking at the courses and there's one course called SOAC and it said like contact owner and all this stuff. And I was talking about it and then turns out it was Carson's uncle the whole time. He's the owner of the course. So just sneaky connection there. But okay, back to the rules thing real quick.
Well, just to let everyone know, the par is 63 at Trophy Lake. So he's thinking you can't shoot three under or more.
Yeah.
And right now, the past 30 days, only two people on UDisc have broken par.
Ooh.
Someone, Mick Flyney, shot 59, and Aero Masmelli.
Starting to rethink that.
I'm not rethinking it, man.
Shot 54. So
I got all gyro. I'm a different person. Disc fly farther, you know?
Just something to think about.
All right. Well, you know what? That'll have to be a video. Break 60 at Trophy Lakes. And
I'm there for it.
All right. We'll figure it out. We'll make sure it happens. You know what? We'll do it Friday morning or something after you're in town.
Yeah.
That'll be our next break series.
Yeah. Is this the big course? Like, this is the course that everyone wants to see you play?
It's the course where, like, A-tier has been there before. Some big names have been down there for it. There's coverage of it on YouTube. It's Connor's favorite course in the world. He hypes it up and then immediately follows it with like, well, don't get it like too hyped though, because I don't want y'all to be disappointed. So
yeah, I was gonna say so it's trash.
Yeah, so I don't know anything about it. He just said it's really fun because you throw over water a bunch. So we'll see. Okay, so back to the rules thing really quick. I think this is where it just comes down to the Pro Tour needs to. To split rules-wise from the PDGA, because a lot of the rules that you need to give the Pro Tour control over, and even some of like the future developments of the game on the pro scene, you just don't want to. The whole reason the PDGA can't do some of those is because like if you give those same rules to random C tiers and stuff, it could get crazy.
Yes.
So like that's the whole that's the issue when rubber meets the road of like. The pro scene needs certain rules and needs certain things, possibly like expansion of circle one, possibly like going to a green instead of a circle, beyond the different types of OBs and other, you know, stroke and distance rules, other possibilities that if you brought all of those just to any TD can use them however they want, it would make for just some of the most miserable C tiers you've ever played. And so that's where it needs to be split.
Yeah, I think just for me as a player, and I think for spectators as well, I think it would help everyone out instead of looking at a hole and being like, all I want to do is look at a hole and be like, where's the OB? Where's the hazard?
Yeah.
Is there a Mando on this hole? Like, I just want to look at like where not to throw, right? Instead of like, how does this hole play?
Yeah.
And like have to understand like, oh, there's a drop zone here. And then, if you don't throw, if you throw an OB over here, you get an advance here. But that's the tricky part of like trying to figure out how every hole plays differently. So that's where I will end it on that. Silas, quick question. Twitter spaces. Are we able to get into Twitter? What was the situation on that? It seems like some people want to have some Twitter space action.
Only way we could do Twitter spaces is if only one of us is on. If that makes sense.
I have to be in studio for Twitter spaces.
Hey, we might be able to do Twitter spaces when we're all in Charleston. Though.
We could do it next week in Charleston. Oh, Brody won't be in Charleston yet.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You know, here's an idea. Here's
an
idea.
Is it not good to do with just the phone up to the mic?
Well, the issue is the delay between you and I. That was like when we used to do it, when we like pre-recorded the show or whatever, however we did it way back when we first started. When you were on Twitter Spaces, then like I would hear your audio and then your audio would come through on my Twitter Spaces like 3 seconds late.
Mm.
So like it was really bad for syncing. But we could possibly go like...
What if I was the only one on Twitter Spaces?
I was going to say, we could go... Mm-hmm. Well, they couldn't hear me. The only way we could do it is if we went slightly rogue and we went like no Brody video or no me video, so they couldn't tell how far behind my audio was, and then we wired in the Twitter Space audio into the board. So you couldn't like see how far behind people were.
Yeah.
That's the only way we could do it, but I don't know. Might be something. Okay. Might
we'll,
be something worth looking
into. We'll think
about
that. Yeah, we'll think about that in the future.
All right. Well, there's a good pausing point to go ahead and thank the sponsors of today's episode. All right. Today's episode is brought to you by Legacy Discs, who is bringing back their Confidence Clash this July. The Confidence Clash is a fun way to run a 3-disc challenge styled event in your area and be able to raise funds for your local club or course. Players packs include 2 premium discs and 1 baseline putter of your host's choice, along with a Legacy towel and sticker sheet. In addition to the players pack, winners will also receive a very nice winners pack. For more information about the Clash and how to run or participate in one, please visit legacydiscs.com/cc22 and remember to play with confidence. Thanks again to Legacy for sponsoring today's video. So back to a topic here that just slipped my mind. Oh, I got to ask you about this, Brody. And you can veto this question, okay? But I've now heard about it multiple times, and I want to know if there's any insider scoop. I've seen now Ben Askren tweet about it, and I've seen Katrina Allen talk about it like 2 or 3 times, that the Celebrity Pro-Am is
dark horse.
That the Celebrity Pro-Am is going down, I think, tomorrow. But,
well, yeah, I dropped out of it, so I think it is happening.
So, but
I
like
I dropped out of some event.
Yeah. So, well, it's obviously happening, but the Pro Tour hasn't pushed it at all.
I don't think it's going to be live.
So is it just like they're waiting until the coverage is done and then they're going to promote it?
That's my guess. Since I haven't seen anything on it either.
Yeah.
So my guess would be that they are like, we're just going to show up to this event. It's not even an event. We're going to show up and basically film this. It's almost like a YouTube video, right?
Yeah.
It's like you're not hyping up. Well, sometimes you do actually hype up a YouTube video. But my guess is they're going to hype up the release of it.
Okay.
Versus actually when it was filmed.
Okay. That makes more sense.
That's what I would guess.
That's what I guessed on Griplocked. But I just remember last year, like it was hyped up leading up to it. And then we were there on the grounds.
I think they went live.
Did they? No, because I don't think so. I think it was all posts. They just had a lot of like social content going out.
They had a lot of social content going out.
Which is going to be hard, like when you have all these pros and whatever celebrities they're able to get, and like no one's like posting stories or something. I don't know. I just thought it was weird that like last year it was like this all leading up to it. It was constantly being promoted, hyped up, and then this year it's just like it's happening, and it's also happening like the day before a major. So like, I would assume Paige and Kat are both going to be there, maybe another FPO player, and they have to roll right into U.S. Women's the day after. I don't know how far away Ben's house is from where U.S. Women's is going down, but, I mean, that could be something interesting,
Were
too.
They... Yeah, Kat and Paige were there last year, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. And I know Kat's going this year, because she's talked about it in, like, 2 or 3 interviews. That's how I heard it was happening. And
interesting.
Yeah, because Kat was talking how this week she came into Wisconsin... And then went to somewhere in Wisconsin and did like a golf event with a high school buddy, and then practiced some, and then has the Celebrity Pro-Am tomorrow, and then the major starts on Thursday. So she has like very little practice going on, which is very interesting. But I just thought it was weird.
Hopefully she handles it better than I did.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting just because I haven't heard about anything with it, but it's probably just the Disc Golf Network's going to like shoot it and then try to hype it when it releases. Maybe last year they hyped it leading up to it, and then by the time it released, people like weren't super like as hyped about it, and so maybe they flipped the strategy this year or something.
Yeah, I love overhyping stuff.
So your next tournament then is Idlewild next weekend, 2 weekends from now. Yeah.
Yes.
You'll leave next week.
Yeah. I'll probably leave up on Monday, my guess is, and start filming the stuff and all that up there.
Are you driving or flying up to Idlewild?
Oh, I'll fly. What the heck?
I didn't know. Kentucky, I mean, Yeah, it's pretty far from Texas. That's very far from Texas. Out. Never mind.
How far do you think? How far do you think that is?
It's got to be like 16 hours. It's got
to
be.
We're about to find out. Cincinnati, Ohio. Yeah, you think I'm a? Yeah, I'm driving 13 hours and 30 minutes for a week, and then turning around and driving right back.
Oh, because you're going back home after. That's right. So yeah, after that, they go Europe, right? They go. Is the Sula Open still happening with the Pro Tour? And then they go European Open after that.
Yeah, I think that's what's happening.
And then it comes back to Diglo.
I don't think I'm getting in. Yeah, because we have Charleston trip.
Yeah. Yeah, the Grand Open.
I don't think I'm getting into the European Open.
No. Well, that's... No, I guess it's the week after the Charleston trip.
Yeah, it doesn't look like I'm getting in. I don't know how you get in. I don't know if it was just a sign-up situation. But apparently they had like passes or something. And yeah, unfortunately, if you're listening to this over in Europe, I will probably not. It's looking like I'm not going
to
be there.
Dang. That's a trip that Trevor and I have talked about. That's on our bucket list. We want to go to the European Open one year.
So I was talking to Albert about it when we were playing the first round together. And I was like, he was basically saying how, you know, a big tournament hasn't happened over there, obviously, since COVID.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And he was saying the crowds that we're getting at the Pro Tour events now in the States are like equivalent to the crowds that they were getting at that tournament.
Oh, yeah.
And
maybe
so
smaller,
I was like,
still.
So I was like, I can only imagine what it's going to be now.
Yeah.
Since like, he was basically just saying how big the crowds in the US have gotten over the last couple of years. We haven't been able to see what that's going to look like over in Europe. And it's if the growth over in the States is anywhere near the growth over in Europe, you might see a massive, massive crowd.
Europe, yeah. European Open was always, because I mean, back like 2015, 16, 17, like that age up to COVID, obviously, it was always like a glimpse into the future of disc golf. Like there was always the like big screen scoreboard, the stanchions lining the fairway that people had to stand behind, like. It was always just felt like what disc golf was like eventually going to be, and we just like got one tournament to like look into it, because even like the players were like all throughout the week, players had clinics and signings and stuff like that that was like booked for them by their sponsors, where like they showed up and they were being driven around to like this pro shop and then this pro shop and stuff like that all week, because like they're only in Europe once a year, so like they've taken advantage of it. And like It was everything that was talked about. You're like, man, I can't wait for the Pro Tour to get to that level. And so now that it's been gone for over 2 years, I'm very, very excited to see, like, is it going to now look just like what disc golf is? Or do they have stuff up their sleeve that we're going to be like, oh, my word. Like, I can't wait. Like, is it going to be a similar feeling again of I can't wait till that gets brought to the States? Like, I can't wait till disc golf's like that here. I'm very, very excited, and it's going to be live this year on the Disc Golf Network, and President's Cup's coming back, which, if you're newer to the sport and you don't know what President's Cup is, it's basically Team USA versus Team Europe. I think the captains just got announced. Very excited for that. That's always one of my favorite events. That's where KJ USA, that nickname came from, was the President's Cup. He was a big part in winning it for the USA back then. So, very stoked for all of that coming up, but... yeah, Silas, let's go ahead and get some chat topics rolling in, unless you have something else that you're missing, Brody. Anything that we haven't talked through?
I mean, shout out to Bradley Williams.
Yeah.
And Paige Pierce.
Yeah.
For two really good wins. Yeah, apparently too, like, geez, that might have been the most throw-ins of any tournament coverage of all time.
There's also so many that scared the basket, because I'd be sitting watching it, and Liz would be like kind of like on her phone on TikTok or something, and I'm just watching the coverage, and then I feel like every like 20-30 minutes I would just scream, because I just thought someone threw something in, and yeah. You know, every once in a while I was right, but a lot of them just went right by the basket somehow.
Yeah, there's a handful of those holes are set up to where you can kind of give them good runs without having to worry too much about. Yeah.
Bradley's throw-in, I think, was the most impressive, personally. Because his was on that very hard par 4 that's like that dog leg. Well, not really a dog leg, but like gets tight tunnel.
Yeah, par 5. It's
par
a hole 5.
Yeah, and then he had
no,
that like
par 4, hole
flex
5.
Flex shot that like slowly panned down. It was a beautifully thrown shot to where that didn't go in, it was going to be like 10 feet past.
where he was there, you're happy with just getting a par. You're happy with just throwing something and then, you know, pitching up and getting a par. So yeah, that was super impressive.
Yeah. Wild, wild stuff.
All right, we got something from Jason. He said stroke and distance needs to be implemented in either the PDGA rules or the Disc Golf Pro Tour. This one simple change would drastically increase the difficulty of the sport and create lower scores. I don't really know.
Lower or higher scores? Maybe he means like...
stroke and distance need to be implemented in either the PDGA rules or the Disc Golf Pro Tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. He means lower scores in the sense of like not shooting 10 under, you're now shooting 5 under.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's
yeah. I mean, I definitely, I don't think it's a PDGA rule. I don't like it. Because again, I just think that it's something that can be abused. But I do think that
it should only be at the Pro Tour.
Yeah. I do think it's a Pro Tour rule. If you go back far enough, USDGC has used it in the past. Ledgestone, when Ledgestone first came on the scene, used it. That's what a big reason people hated Ledgestone when the first tournament was like first happened.
How many years ago was that?
20, I don't know when Ledgestone came to be about. It was like the first like year or two Ledgestone was about. I mean, you saw some people taking some absurd numbers out there.
Yeah, but roughly how many years ago was that?
5 or 6, well, maybe. Yeah. If I had to guess,
You got to remember too. This is, people are starting to forget too that like the fields at these Pro Tour events are starting to get better and better and better.
Yeah.
Right. So that ledge 5 years ago, you probably had like 60, 70 people in the field that just like, yeah, maybe on their good weeks they could play decent. But they're going to have a lot of bad weeks, and you know that's going to slow down pace of play. And I, you know, that's why everyone's like worried about stroke and distance is like pace of play. It's going to take forever. People are just gonna, and it's like not really like the people on this tour. I don't think we should be, like I threw probably 5 shots around where I'd get to my disc and I'm like, how is this in bounds?
Yeah.
That's obviously different than stroke and distance. That more goes in the lines of like, I'm always saying like, I think you should have more OB, more hazard and stuff. But there's a lot of times where I'm just like standing and I'm like, I'm going to get the same score as this guy over here that threw a perfect shot off the tee. And yeah, so it kind of goes hand in hand with stroke and distance of where it's like, why are we making it to where we're like, well, we don't want someone to like take a huge number on a on a hole. It's like, well, then don't take a huge number on a hole. Yeah. Execute the shot. You don't have to throw a perfect shot. Just throw a shot in bounds. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think, because you also get the argument, too, from some people thinking that, like, stroke and distance is going to make disc golf more boring to watch. Like, people are going to play safer. And it's like, yeah, the people maybe in the lead, the people in the lead might be playing safer. But also, when you're playing a hole that has tons of stroke and distance, i.e., 17 at USDGC, good luck trying to play that hole safer with nerves. What does that look like? We've seen that before.
Yeah.
Like the nerves come in whether you want to play safe or not. And I think if the hole is designed well, stroke and distance can be really, really exciting.
Yeah.
Really exciting.
Well, I think too, the biggest thing for stroke and distance is like, well, the argument of like people are going to play safer, like the people who play safer because of stroke and distance aren't going to be in the lead, because like there's going to be someone who doesn't every week and is still going for stuff, and that player is still going to shoot low. Like it's going to work out for someone. But it like you were saying, like hole 17 at USDGC is a great example. It's gotten easier as the years went on to where like now after you miss the island a few times, you go to a drop zone, all that stuff that then used to exist. Yeah. So it's still plenty that you can blow a tournament, but like, there's some holes on tour that just like with stroke and distance coming down the stretch, no lead safe. Cause it's like you throw, like you missing the Mando. The second you miss that first Mando, if it is re-T like you thought it was, that second Mando shot has a lot more pressure. The second you miss it a second time, you're now looking at that thing and it's like, it might as well be the smallest gap in the world. Like I'm sure this didn't cross your mind, but it would have crossed mine of like, do I jump putt and just get myself like to the gap?
No, I was thinking after I missed the third time, I was thinking, do I just throw a forehand through the gap?
Yeah. like that's what I'm saying, though, is like those type of things. Like imagine that hole is actually how it's played, and it's hole 17, and you have like a 5-stroke lead. Like yeah, the second you miss the Mando once, someone in the chat was asking what stroke and distance is. Basically, stroke and distance is you don't advance to where the disc went OB. So like right now in normal PDGA rules,
it's really, really hard. A lot of holes, really, really hard to take a score worse than a bogey.
Yeah.
So, like you have to do something really bad to take a higher score than a bogey on a lot of holes.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We got one from Lou here. He says, how much longer do you think the Disc Golf Pro Tour can continue broadcasting the final rounds for free? And will it make sense for a earlier round to be free instead of the final rounds?
I mean, I think don't they want to eventually be able to like get off of subscription base?
I don't know.
I think you eventually want to be able to make your money from sponsors. Cause I think it's obviously, I mean, view us right now. Like I think Foundation in the short term, we probably would have made more money if we would have put everything behind a paywall. Right. And we're like, if you want to see our content, you need to pay $5 a month. Short term, we probably make more money than we did. Like when we first started, we probably make more money than we were just making off of YouTube. But I just don't think you can grow fast that kind of path.
No.
And so you end up long term, you end up making way less. And I think that's the same with something like this, of where right now they probably do need money. Right. And so for them, it makes sense to do stuff behind the paywall, but I'm assuming they want to eventually get it to where they have sponsors and all this stuff, where they're making enough money that way, because then you can grow the audience, you can get more and more people, and then you charge the sponsors more and more money.
Yeah, well, I think the paywall will exist, but I think it will eventually follow more of a golf model to a certain extent, where like round one, it might be like almost fully behind a paywall or whatever, but more so behind the paywall, you can watch like certain cards live. So you can like choose stuff like that.
Yeah, obviously. But we're talking about just the main coverage.
I think
the next step needs to be free.
I think the next step, obvious to me, is the second day becomes free as well. Like the last 2 days. Cause like that's the most exciting golf.
Yeah.
And you want as many eyes on the most exciting golf as you can. If you're aiming for growth, if subscription yes. model is the long-term play for them and that's what they want, is like everything's always behind a paywall, then yeah, you might want to put the early round, like if that's the model, yeah, you might want to put the early rounds for free and the late rounds behind the paywall, because that's what people want to watch. But if you do that, you're going to end up making a lot less money in the long term, because I mean, then you're just secluding your audience to only people who are willing to pay $5-$10 a month to watch this.
Yeah, it's tough, because I think right now you're in a tricky spot of where the sport is small enough to where it's really hard to get big sponsors to pay a lot of money.
Yeah.
But to get bigger, you need to kind of open up the doors so that you can kind of have some organic growth, because, you know, you look at a boxing model of how they do business, of where everything is subscription, right? You have to pay $70, $85 to watch a fight. Like that works though for them, because they're at a level where there's so much media, there's so much hype, there's so much buildup to these fights that it at least gets known to a big majority of people. And then they get to decide whether or not they want to pay to watch, where there are tons of people out there that just have no idea that they could pay to watch disc golf.
Yeah. And then at that point, like paying to watch boxing, you can get people who don't care anything about sports to want to watch someone beat the snot out of someone else.
Yeah. Combat sports are different for sure than other sports for sure.
So like, I don't really think you can fully take a combat sport model and copy and paste it into a sport like golf at the end of the day.
Maybe you could have like some free events and then some of like the bigger.
They've tested that this year. They've done some events where it's like live is free and then like to give you like a little tease of it and stuff.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that the model's got to be getting more to distributing it for free.
Yeah.
And doing that. I mean, realistically, when they go live, it'd also be smart to go live on as many platforms at the same time as possible. Right. Push it on Facebook, go live on Twitter, go, because then you can just pool all these audiences to where, yeah, you might only have 100 people on Twitter watching the Disc Golf Pro Tour live stream, but like that's 100 you don't have on YouTube.
Right.
So like you do that on YouTube, Facebook, Twitch, all of these, especially like ones like Twitch and a few, like Twitch, I guess, is the only one that would work for them. But like there's a chance that you get enough viewers that it gets to like a trending page or something. And then it gets more random eyeballs just stumbling on it. But to me, I mean, I think that's got to be down the road. It's just tough right now because Disc Golf is still trying to improve their live product and they need a lot of money to improve their live product, but they don't have the eyeballs on it yet because it's behind a paywall to get that type of money.
Right.
And if they brought it outside the paywall,
then they wouldn't be making,
they might not have nearly as much money to sustain what they already have built.
Right.
So it's like the toughest part with how we're growing the sport right now, coverage wise, is knowing when to make the jump.
Yeah.
Because when you have that consistent income,
that's a risk.
Yeah. You have that consistent income of the paywall right now. And it's just like every month they're getting that check. They know it's coming. They know they can sustain everything.
Right. It's
yeah.
I think
it's tough to know when to jump.
I think you make the jump when ideally you either have a sponsor that is like, listen, we don't want this behind a paywall. We want as many people to see it as possible. We're paying you $100,000 an event. So this needs to be live and we need to get as many people as possible. I think you make the jump then, because then obviously you just go from, you go from money from the viewers to money from a company that's trying to get viewers to see their stuff. Or you make the jump when there's a network that is willing to pick it up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's when that's I think those two situations, one of them have to happen.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right. We got this is a good topic.
There's a lot of questions rolling in, Silas. You got to catch up, boy.
Yeah. All right. We got one, and they said, "What about a cumulative timer for each player? Like in curling and chess tournaments, each player would get 30 seconds."
We'll talk about this before. Simply, all that needs to happen is when there's a huge gap between two groups, someone needs to come up and say, "Listen, hey, there's a big gap." Like we did it. We had to look for Albert's disc. Looking for someone's disc is always awkward. We were looking for his disc for probably about 2 minutes. And after 2 minutes, he was like, "All right, I'm going to start the timer." It's very awkward to be like, when you first start looking for a disc, to be like, "All right, I'm starting the timer."
Yeah.
So it ended up taking probably 4.5 minutes of looking to find his disc. So we got kind of far behind. And I just basically told our group, because we don't have any marshals around, but I was like, "Yo, listen, we got to try speed up to pick up to, you know, to catch up to the group." But that's all you need to do. I don't think a cumulative timer, you don't need any of that stuff. Literally, you just need someone to say like, "Hey, listen, you guys are playing slow. The group in front of you is a hole ahead of you. You need to catch up to them." And oh, then,
all right.
And then from there, you're good. Yeah.
Brody, what are three professional players' biggest issues with Elite Series events? Pet peeves, if you will. You have any pet peeves of Elite Series events?
What?
It's saying, I think it's saying like, as a professional player, what are your three pet peeves? Like, what three things would you change about an Elite Series event?
There you go.
I don't have anything that comes up to my mind. All maybe right. If there were some examples.
Well, I mean, we talked about the rules today, so there's one.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. I don't know if I wouldn't really consider it a pet peeve.
No.
I would just say I think it's something that, to me, a pet peeve is like something like someone asking you for an autograph right before you're about to throw.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, how has, I guess, really quickly, how have you noticed a difference in the tour as a whole this year of like player spectator separation as it is compared to the past?
Yeah, they have the tournaments that they have, the little spectator lines up all over, have been incredible. The tournaments that they haven't had those lines aren't nearly as good.
Nice. Sweet. There you go.
There you go. Um, What do you think about the high-paid contracts? Kona, Ricky, and Paul are all struggling. I don't know about that. Only Paige and Kristen are playing up to their big contracts.
Yeah, I mean...
I wouldn't say Ricky's struggling.
Well, I mean, it's... Again, we've talked about it before on Grip Locked at least multiple times where... more in particular with Paul and Paige is like their whole brand was built on dominance, and now we're in an era where dominance, it doesn't exist. So like your perception of players and what people expect of these players is like, it's got to be different nowadays. And at the end of the day, they got all these players, every single one of them got the contract because the company thinks they can move the discs. And so regardless of play on the field or on the course, if they're moving the discs, then it's a good contract. It's a good signing. But I do think it's something that as disc golf fans, we have to, like people who have been in the sport like me, when you've seen like 2015, 16, 2017, Rick, stuff like that, when you've seen these seasons happen, seasons like that just aren't really going to happen anymore. Like you're not going to have players go an entire year finishing inside the top three only. That's not going to happen.
I'll put it this way. I was pretty open during my Ultimate Frisbee time to make it very clear that if athletes in other sports all of a sudden decided, you know what, I want to start playing Ultimate Frisbee, that I would be very lucky if I somehow still made it on one of the teams. And if I was somehow lucky enough to stay on one of the teams, I would probably be primarily like a handler. I would stay back and throw. That would be my job. And this is coming from someone that had a pretty good career throwing and receiving, doing both. I was very clear about that throughout college and throughout my, you know, club and pro level, because I had a pretty good gauge on the type of people I was going up against. I think that is what we're starting to see now is you have some people that have been honest, I guess, would be the good answer with themselves of like where disc golf was 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago, and have seen where it's going. And you have some people that haven't necessarily been honest with themselves about where it was. And I think a lot of people this season, last season, I think it started this season. I think it's definitely hitting home for a lot of people of where, you know, remove those three people and talk about some people that have just been top 20 guys that just every event they go to, they cash, they get top 20. Like if you talk to those people, they'll be like, yeah, sometimes I just don't even cash at these events. Like I'm not even playing that bad and I'm not cashing. It's happening all the way down the list. And it's going to continue as money goes. It's just like literally anything. As money gets into a sport, you're going to get better athletes. You're going to get people that are more dedicated. You're going to get people that are more fired up about it and are going to put in more work than other people. And we're starting to slowly see that. And I think when the purses start getting astronomically higher, if they ever do, I don't know if they will, but if they ever do, I wouldn't be surprised if someone that people thought was really, really good at disc golf is like not even making it at events anymore.
Yeah.
Because the level of growth in disc golf is just going to continue to go up and up and up. And the easiest way of looking at it is like if you look at the PGA Tour. And also the thing I will say too is when courses start getting harder and harder, because we've all played, perfect example, you guys are very familiar with Falling Creek. The people listening to this podcast are very familiar with Falling Creek with all the videos. If you go out to Falling Creek and you play Falling Creek Reds, your good day versus your bad day is not that far apart.
Yeah.
You're not going to go out there and shoot even par one day and shoot 16 under the other day. The course is just too easy. So when you start having these harder courses, now all of a sudden, if you do play really, really well, yeah, you can shoot 9, 10 under par, but you can also shoot 3 over. And so if you look at the PGA Tour and you look at that style, it is not like when someone misses a cut over there, like a top 10 player in the world misses a cut, it's not really news. No one's like, oh my God, is this person like, has he lost it? Does he not know how to hit a golf ball anymore? Because everyone realizes like golf is very difficult and sometimes you don't have it. So something to think about.
Yeah, I just saw a comment that said some people running for the PGA board this year are against it. So I'm curious. I tried looking up on, I like did a quick
against what?
That's what I'm wondering. Are they saying against the big contracts? Which, like, if so, the PGA, I mean, they got no say in that. But I'm
no,
just,
there's no way they're talking about the contracts.
I'm curious of what, like, I don't know when that comment came across while we were talking.
Seifker 88. What were you talking about?
I'm curious to hear what they're talking about. But yeah, go ahead and get another topic, Silas.
Yeah. Let's see. We got one from.
Oh, sorry. Real quick. I from Fresno just said another sport that's very similar. MMA. So like UFC, for example, like everyone thought Ronda Rousey was disgusting. And like, oh my God, Ronda Rousey's the best thing ever. Well, no, it was just at that point in time, she was the best in the group of women that were fighting. And there was such a small class. At that point, there really weren't that many women that were like training in MMA. And you would basically just have like one style of fighting. And her style of fighting, it's kind of like rock, paper, scissors, right? And she was just shooting fire every time and beating everyone because fire is better than rock, paper, and scissors. And everyone just had a rock or they just had scissors. Now, people, if you look at like Juliana Pena, Amanda Nunes, Valentina Shevchenko, if you look at all the top women in all these different divisions, Rose Namajunas, they all have everything. They can do everything now. And Ronda was kind of a one-trick pony, but her one trick was far superior than everyone else's one trick. So that's a good example, too, is as money was going into MMA and people are like, wait a second, I can be a millionaire. All I have to do is get punched in the face and do a better job of punching someone else in the face. You started to see it go way up. So this is not uncommon in other sports when they're in their infancy. And realistically, disc golf, 100 years from now, this time period is going to be like the infancy. This is not going to be, this is not like the prime time disc golf. Like disc golf is so young that there's just so much for it to grow. And, you know, it's cool that we're in kind of the early stages of it. And we can kind of see over our lifetime just how much, because like the NFL, for example, the NFL doesn't really change that much in our lifetime.
Yeah.
Like what the NFL is now, I can't really think. Back when I'm watching in high school, I don't really, you know, that's what, gosh, I'm old. So that's like 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I'm not really thinking like, oh man, the NFL's changed a lot. But like 20 years from now, disc golf could be astronomically a completely different sport.
Yeah, there's a lot that
also after,
could be changed so far.
Also, after playing with David Wiggins, there is the ceiling for how far people can throw. Holy smokes.
That's actually a great transition because he's going to be in town next week, which first off, I think we're going to do a signing in the in-person store.
I think he can throw farther than you and Trevor if
we're
going to
do it
one shot.
We're going to do it. We're going to go to the Lynchburg College Field, and we're going to start it off just a normal distance contest so people can just see. Because I've never seen him throw in person. I'm very, very excited.
Still on tour.
And then we're going to go.
Well, it might be a little close, but.
Then we're going to go Trevor and I combined distance against David Wiggins. And I'm very, very excited for that.
I don't know if I pick you guys.
Well, the thing is, if we both hit a good shot, we can break over 800 combined. But there's a solid chance one of us only gets out like 350. And if the other person only goes like 300, he's smoking us.
The thing is like...
I mean, surely you're going in 300.
You would think, but I think it's going to be a fun video no matter what.
Yeah. No, that'll be...
The thing is, though, I watched him throw like 650, and it was a golf line.
Yeah.
It wasn't like one of these crazy, like Double G throws really far. Like I've seen Double G throw really far, but he throws like these astronomical high guy annies and like gets, this guy threw 600 feet with the disc 40 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
Like a laser beam, 600, like the disc was coming out at like 80,
88 miles per hour. Like, it was
that's so crazy. We're gonna take him. Like, he doesn't even like he just looks like he's throwing normal too. It's he doesn't have like a super weird throw or anything.
No, well, he's just been doing it for so long. He broke 400 feet when he was like 10 or 11.
Jeez.
Someone, Robert Leonard, told a story on Twitter. I think he told it on Facebook too. I think it was when David Wiggins was like 13. He aced this hole and ran up to Robert Leonard and was like, "Robert, I just aced a hole you can't even reach." And it was a 520 foot par four. And the dude was like 13 years old.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I am so excited. He's going to be in town next week. I think we're going to do a signing in the in-person store if you live locally and want to meet this guy.
Oh, heck
David
yeah.
Wiggins. If you've played disc golf for any amount of time, you know who he is. If not, he's the world distance record holder. Like Brody just said, one of the farthest, if not the farthest thrower of a disc in the world. So, very excited to have him in the area, and it's going to be fun to have him throw against Trevor and I.
I'm glad. I don't know if we kind of got unfortunately timed out with like our video, our doubles battle. I don't think a lot of people have seen it, so I'm hoping maybe over the next couple of days more people go and check it out, because we did. It's one of the farthest throwing cards. It's me, Ezra. I was probably the shortest. I can get Ezra on a good throw, but Ezra, I think, probably consistently throws farther than me. But it was me, Ezra, Double G, and David Wiggins. And if you haven't yet watched this doubles battle, like, I love seeing some of the comments, because apparently there has been some talk about him, like, winning the distance contest. He beat Simon, or, like, Simon tried to beat him, or something happened. And obviously, Simon can't do anything wrong, and if you do anything against Simon, you're going to get a bunch of haters coming after you kind of thing. It was one of those things of where I think he was getting some flack and people thinking like his distance record was kind of like a fluke or whatever. But then people that watched this video were like, okay, it's not a fluke.
Yeah.
Because it's very clear that this guy throws farther than anyone on the planet right now. So that's, to me, when I was watching this, I was like, dude, when are we going to get to the point of where people are consistently throwing like these 360 shots, like off of tees?
It's going to be electric.
And throwing it like 600 feet.
Yeah.
Like that's coming. That's coming. At some point, there are going to be a handful of people that can do that.
Yeah.
And then like the normal distance is going to be like, not normal, but like, throwing 500 feet, just gonna be like, eh.
Yeah, I'm excited to see him at the Lynchburg College Field, because I've never seen someone even come close to reaching the other end. I don't think he'll be able to either, but it's definitely gonna be the farthest I've ever seen a disc fly in person.
Yeah, I mean it's nuts. That's gonna be a good video.
Yeah, and we're also gonna take him. We're debating if we're gonna take him to New London or Falling Creek, because Falling Creek, he'll be able to just throw over everything, and that could like make that course very funny. Versus like New London, yeah, you got to throw far, New but it's London like controlled lines.
Yeah, New London wouldn't be as fun, I think.
Falling Creek will be electric.
Falling Creek yellows would be really fun.
I think that's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to get those New videos. London,
New London, half those holes are mids.
Yeah.
There's like straight mid shots.
And then we might, if we have time, I think we might try to like for a social, I don't know if it's a full video, get him to try to teach Trevor and I a 360. Because like I know how to throw it, but like I want to learn from him.
That could be like a good Patreon video, like a bonus Patreon video.
Yeah. Because I mean, I'm very, very excited for next week. But yeah, if you're in town and you want to meet him, he's throwing a disc like 1,108 feet or something. You're in town and want to meet him, swing by the shop. I believe it's gonna be Tuesday. We'll post about the details in a little bit.
He still holds like the record.
World record. Yeah, right? No one's touching that thing.
Yeah, he said I think it's been record for like 10 years or something.
Yeah, he did it when he's still young. He's like 2 years older than me. I think he's 27.
Oh really?
So he broke it when he was like 17 or 18.
He's not an old guy at all.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I didn't realize he was that young. I didn't realize he was like my age. Makes me feel like, what am I doing with my life? I can only throw a disc 400 feet.
That's crazy.
Well, you also,
and he took a break too.
Can you hit a home run? Can you hit a home run, Hunter?
Mm-mm.
You hit one out of the park?
Mm-mm, definitely not.
Can you dunk a basketball?
Mm-mm. Touched rim once.
All right.
Once.
One time.
Brody, you hitting them out of the park?
What?
You hitting them out of the park?
I don't think I've ever hit a home run. I think I stopped playing baseball like at coach's pitch. I talked about the story, Silas.
What?
The dangers of coach's pitch and my nightmares with it. I've talked about the story.
I don't think so. I've never heard this.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Coach's pitch, we had one girl on the team. She was the pitcher, and the coach pitched the ball, and the kid just hit a line drive right back at him. Coach dove out of the way, and here's Sally just like right behind him.
Oh my.
And the ball just drills her right in the face, like knocks out a tooth, blood everywhere. And I'm like, yeah, I'm good.
Oh no.
I'm good with baseball.
That's fair. All right, Silas, let's get one or two more from the chat.
All right.
We just had the bot pop back in, so I banned them again. But beyond that.
So many bots.
All right. We got – this is a fun one. We got
– is it a fun one?
I love when you say there's a fun
it's
one.
It's such a fun one.
Because I remember seeing it.
It is a fun one. Let me try to find it.
Yeah.
Okay, basically, here we go. If you could create a card with any person from history, dead or alive, who are you picking?
Disc golf or like anyone?
We'll narrow it down. We'll go disc golf.
Yeah, disc golf player from history.
This is my least favorite question. I abstain.
I'm picking this card. Okay. Anyone, so can I pick like them in any stage in history?
Just the person.
So like if I'm playing with someone, they're now like 95 years old playing with me?
Well, okay. No, we'll go in their prime.
Okay.
Whenever.
I'm going prime Climo, prime Macbeth.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, Macbeth technically is prime. I'll go 2015 Macbeth, prime Climo, myself, because I got to be there to watch it. And who's another one to be interested to see? I mean, really, I just want to see that because, like, I want to know I want to see what it would actually look like because that's been an argument for so long.
Are they using their own discs? Like, what's going on?
Because, like, obviously, no, they use today's discs. So then it removes that side of the argument. So it's just raw talent. But
like, how good is Clive going to be with discs that he's never thrown? Or are you assuming he's just as good throwing those discs? That's the assumption?
I think the assumption is like I'm taking him, I'm putting him into today's era is my assumption. So he knows his current
He
bag.
Knows all the
It's
discs.
Basically yeah, like he, his arm talent from back then with today's discs.
Gotcha.
What happens.
Okay, gotcha.
And then we'll just throw like 2016 or 17 Rick into it. Just for the fun
just,
of it.
Just for the fun. Just yeah. In the mix.
Yeah, because like, what if Rick just dominates it? Or you know what? If we can pull Climo from like his like 20s, 30s, then I'm taking Gannon from the future. Mm. I'm taking a 25-year-old Gannon Burr.
You don't have to be on the card.
Oh, I'm not on the card either.
You don't have to be.
Okay, so I'm taking a 25-year-old Gannon Burr.
You can spectate.
And then I'm going. Then I'm just picking some.
I love how the question was literally three people outside of disc golf, and you're picking all disc golfers.
Well, I narrowed
Silas
it down.
Told me disc
I,
golfers.
No, I narrowed it down. I
Silas told
down.
Me disc golfers, okay?
We had to have some constraints.
And if it's
on
three people,
question.
That's what I'm going. I'm going 25-year-old Gannon Burr, 2015 Paul Macbeth, and Ken Climo in his prime, whatever age that is of Ken Climo. And we're just letting him battle it out, and I'm sitting on the sideline with popcorn. Boom.
Not a pretzel.
Why not a pretzel? Yeah, why not a pretzel?
Well, like, if you're watching something go down, I'm not participating in it. I'm eating popcorn. But, if I'm on the card, I'm eating a pretzel.
I mean, that's just... You didn't say pretzel first, but...
Silas, a lot of nerve,
suspect
man.
To me, Silas.
That's pretty
me.
Sus.
Hey, Silas, you know that you have... You know you have to present your presentation again live for me in Charleston, right?
What?
Yeah, Brody. Yep. Brody said he's intentionally not watched the presentation yet.
Oh, boy.
I went live. Wait,
let's, not gonna lie. Let's, I think
let's,
I deleted.
Let's let him know stipulations. Let's yeah. let him know stipulations.
So basically, Tyler. What's gonna end up happening, Silas, is Brody's gonna get in town. We're gonna live stream you giving your presentation to Brody.
Oh, live stream.
Okay, and Brody's decision is if your presentation, it's the same presentation. Don't change it.
I think I deleted it. I'm gonna have to remake it.
Okay, you can remake it.
Why would you delete the presentation?
I don't know.
Anyways. if your presentation,
if it can be recovered,
if your presentation's good enough, then you're the fourth man for Foundation versus the Nation.
Okay.
If Brody says no, that's not it, then you're filming, and Connor's the fourth man of Foundation versus the Nation.
Mm.
So you're in Charleston, no matter what. I mean, we could just get him a bus ticket and just send him back home.
No.
Send him back.
No, we'll go. We'll go. Yeah, we'll just go the. We'll just go. You're either playing Foundation versus the Nation, or you're filming Foundation versus the Nation.
Oh boy,
it all comes down to your presentation.
That's big.
Should we have him give a separate presentation now that we know it's been deleted?
Okay, if your presentation has been deleted, Silas.
Yeah.
Okay, and you can't recover it, then I think the presentation should be why you should be playing in the Foundation
over Connor.
Over Connor.
Over Connor?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's either you or Connor.
I already got ideas. Okay. I already got ideas.
Well, yeah, if your presentation's been deleted, then we'll give you that chance.
Okay.
We'll allow you to remake it to try to impress us on why you should be.
And we're all just going to sit around. We're all going to have pretzels, and we're just going to watch this thing. Yeah. And
I mean, well, hey, I've got one in the bag. Now I know what to do better.
Oh, you're not pitching us now. Save it for the presentation.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying I know what to do better.
Save it for presentation, man.
and everybody else online will be able to see it as well.
Yeah. Okay.
I could be swayed a little bit by if the chat is loving the presentation.
Yeah.
Okay. I could be swayed.
All right, chat. You're gonna have to be on my side for this one. You're always on my side.
I mean, the tough part is you're going against Connor, which the chat's definitely on Connor's side.
Yeah, but there's been some swayage. There's been some movements happening.
Oh. Where are these movements going down? Huh? You're becoming the favorite?
No, I never said that. I will never say that.
I don't know.
But I've seen some YouTube comments and everything saying, you know, we need a Connor versus Silas battle.
I have seen that. I have seen the Connor versus Silas thing.
Maybe we'll see that in Charleston. Who knows? Who knows what the future holds? We could see it though.
There you go.
Silas, do you have a name for your fans? For the Plastic Addicts? Do you have a name?
I don't. Any suggestions?
Are you? No, I don't know. But I'm saying, are you going to like
Thigh Guys?
You know, are you going to make a plead for them to watch your presentation and give good feedback?
Oh, of course. Yeah, there'll be.
All right. Because if you show a big fan base of people that want to see you compete. I'm a numbers guy. It's going to be hard for me to, you know, shy away from that.
Oh, the fans are for sure going to show up.
The Silas Army. The Psy Guy Army.
Yeah. The Psy Guy Army.
The Psy Guys. The Silos. The Psychos. The Psychos.
The Psychos.
Just spelled S-I-C-O-S. Sickos. The Sickos.
The Sickos.
I don't know. It's a work in progress. Well, you just have it before you get to Charleston.
Hey, I mean, there are people already in the chat saying they're going to show up, so that's all we need.
Did he say Thigh Guys? Thigh Guy. Something to think about. All right, I think that's a good note to end the show on. So if you're in Charleston, be sure to come out. We're going to have lots of events going on, some two Bogey Bro battles, a Foundation versus the Nation you can play in, and then, of course, the Creators Cup is going to be going down. All that's going to be happening the week, July 11th through the 17th, specifically the Creators Cups, the 16th and the 17th, and the Foundation Disc Golf Charleston is going to be opening July 16th. Hopefully next week we'll have some details of some sneaky stuff that's going to be there on the grand opening. So if you're within driving distance, anywhere down in that South Carolina area, I would block it off on your calendar because you're going to want to be in the store. Brody's going to be there doing a signing. We're going to guaranteed at least some Dark Horse stuff. Guaranteed some, possibly some super Dark Horse stuff. We'll put it that way.
That's fair.
I think that's a good way to put it. Guaranteed Dark Horse stuff, possibly the darkest of horse stuff. What's the final form of the Dark Horse? The Fire Horse?
Mega Dark Horse.
Mega Dark Horse. Possibly some Mega Dark Horse stuff. So you definitely want to stay tuned to that. Also check out brodysmith.discraft.com tomorrow night, 7 p.m. Eastern time, correct?
Yeah.
A lot of stuff going down there. Get sneaky, glow get freakies, stuff. Hats, shirts, OG stamp buzzes, all kinds of fun stuff. You're going to check it all out.
Did Silas throw the get sneaky further than you forehand?
I think he lied about his distance, if we're being completely honest.
Whoa, what?
I wasn't going to call him out.
334 in a football field.
And you also weren't throwing from the end zone. How'd you throw 340?
That was from the end zone. That's cap.
I was filming in the end zone. I was standing in the end zone.
We were both in the end zone.
You were in front of me. You threw 344.
No, we were both in the end zone.
It didn't go into the other end zone.
On the other
I think it was very...
If it was close to the other end zone, you didn't throw 344.
How far was that?
Well,
it's like 300 feet.
Even if it's to the other end zone, if you went end zone to end zone, that's 300 feet.
Yeah.
Oh.
I threw it end zone out of the out of the park. So
maybe I need a range finder.
How did you measure?
It was just I was eyeballing.
You eyeballed it.
Yeah.
Oh, he definitely didn't throw 344.
Why did you say 344?
Huh? Why was it so specific? Where did the four come from?
Because that was my guess.
What? You can't just put up a number that's super specific.
Why not? That was my guess.
Put like approximately 350 feet. Like when you put 344, everyone just goes, oh, this guy measured. He threw 344 feet. You might only throw 250.
No, it's not that.
Oh, my word. Unbelievable.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
I can get it.
I was like, 344. He's on a football field.
We're going tomorrow. We're filming. Okay.
Yeah.
We're playing New London.
Yeah.
We're going to the driving range. I'm gonna get in on the story. You're throwing the get sneaky.
Sick.
I'm range finding it. You put a blizzard on it. If it's not 344, if it's not farther than 344, you owe me a blizzard. And if it is, okay. I'll owe you one.
Give him 330.
No.
344?
344.
So if it's 345 or farther, I'll give you a blizzard. If it's shorter, you owe me one.
Yeah.
Forehand.
Yeah.
Great. All right.
I'm making that all day.
I'll take Reese's
with a chocolate center.
I can't believe you did a review on a disc and threw up a very specific number, and it was just a pure guess.
I thought it was U-Disc. I thought you used U-Disc, and it was like plus or minus 20-some feet. And I was like, I could give it to him. That's probably like 300, 320, and U-Disc gave him 344. But no, this guy, I saw someone said that he cyballed it. This guy was out in the field cyballing it.
Wow.
Unbelievable. All right, we'll talk to you next week. Check the story tomorrow if you want to see Silas owe me a blizzard. Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys. Podcasts, TikTok.
Oh, nice. So
and we can just throw all the podcast clips up there.
Yeah, because we're doing more just like TikToks.
Yeah, we're doing like some trends and then us throwing.